Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Who's going to change your light bulbs when you're 85 years old? It could be yourself, your husband or wife, or your daughter-in-law. Maybe she lives nearby. But what if you're living solo and not up for climbing a stepladder? There are a lot of practical and financial challenges that solo seniors have that others don't. We'll talk about how to plan for this scenario with seniors advocate Carol Marack. Then, playing favorites, why it might pay to play that game with your financial advisor, but not in the way you might think. We'll talk about how to get the most out of your money manager. Fraser Rice is our guest. He's the author of a new book called Wealth, Actually, Intelligent Decision-Making for the 1%. And the markets are volatile over time, of course, but stocks can produce tremendous wealth. If you're in it for the long term, your investments will likely produce a pretty big pile of cash. But how much of that cash will you actually get to keep? With high fees, it might not be that much. We're going to talk to the author of a new book called Beat the Bank. Larry Bates will be here. Plus, a marriage goes well beyond the wedding day, and topics like personal finance should definitely be included in that relationship. With more and more women today attaining higher levels of education and succeeding professionally, it's important to know how to protect your financial interest in a relationship. Meridian's Amy Burke will tell us more about that. And cars for kids, what you need to know to help the student in your life buy their first pair of wheels. We'll talk cost-effective shopping strategies with Auto Trader's Jacob Black. All that's ahead. Let's get started. More and more seniors are retiring alone. Maybe they never married or they've gotten divorced. Maybe they chose not to have kids or their kids live far, far away now. Regardless, solo seniors face some additional challenges as they age, given that they don't have a spouse or kids around for support. Carol Marack is the Chief Public Relations Officer at Senior Care and an advocate for solo seniors. She joins us now from Dallas, Texas. Hello there.
Hi. Thank you for having me today. I appreciate it very much.
Our pleasure. I use the phrase solo seniors. You use the phrase elder orphans. Tell us a bit more about what we're talking about here.
Oh, certainly. Well, by the way, most people do not like the term elder orphans, but unfortunately, it has been voted to be used by geriatricians who do research on the topic of people who are aging alone. And so that's why I use it, because it certainly does, you know, grab attention, and it really says, you know, our predicament. I mean, it really describes the predicament of people who are aging at home alone. Because if we say solo agers, which we are, or aging alone, which we are doing that as well, but elder orphan really describes the predicament, I think.
Tell us more about some of the challenges that people in this circumstance face. Now, this is a personal finance program. Certainly, those are the things that I focus most on. But give us cover the waterfront here on what people have to deal with.
Absolutely. Thank you for asking. Yeah, as a matter of fact, we just completed an academic research study of the group. And one of the hardest issues that we face, well, we face several, actually, but the one of them is right up your alley, and it's 78% of those who participated in the survey, which were 500, 78% of them have no help making financial decisions or help with paying bills. And 55% have no help with making medical decisions.
Big deals. Now, on the financial services front, what's out there for people? Because one of the things I read about in my research was something called the daily money managers. This seems to be a category of service provider that we don't have here in Canada.
Now, is that a service that helps people pay their bills?
I mean,
a person who'll do it. Yeah, there are several of them, but you know, we have to be cautious on who we allow access to our finances because of all the elder abuse, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I do know of several services that are headed up by attorneys, and who I think I would prefer an attorney handling my financial financial matters, maybe, over just, you know, a layperson, I think.
You started the Elder Orphans Facebook group back in 2016. The response has been very, very strong. What were you trying to do, and how do you feel like you're helping people who are solo?
Well, the reason I started the group is because I am aging alone. I'm not married, nor do I have a partner or adult children. I was a family caregiver for both my parents. My dad lived with Alzheimer's. My mom lived with several chronic conditions. And after they passed, I thought, oh my gosh, that was a lot of work. Mm. Family caregiving is very burdensome. I mean, it's not that I would not want to do that again for my parents. It's just that it took a lot from the siblings, from me and my two sisters. But with that said, after they passed, I realized, oh my gosh, who's going to do all of that for me? Mm-hmm. And so that was very startling to me. And I thought, well, I wonder how many other people are in my situation. And that's when I launched the group, because I wanted to know, first off, are there other people like me who are aging alone? And secondly, if there are, how can we, create a community and bond and help one another? And so we are, you know, it's almost, well, past 2.5 years, I guess. I'm going on close to 3. And we have, that's exactly what we're doing. It's really phenomenal, the support that we give one another. And what's even more remarkable is how resourceful we are, because we've had to depend only upon ourselves. That we, if a person or a member in the group posts a question or concern or an issue that she or he's dealing with, then it really blows my mind how much advice and really worthy information that is shared in the group on how people tackle these issues.
The collective wisdom.
Yes, that's it. Very good.
What are some of the resources that have surfaced that people really gravitate to? What are some of the first things that you would recommend people research and see if they can find and light up in their home community?
So the first thing would be, to me, is the most important is, number one, start building your network of support. You know, don't be left high and dry with a low support system. That could either be with your neighbors, your friends. It could even be maybe with your nieces or nephews, or going to a senior center, but start building your support team. Those friendships that can help you, help you in situations if you, say, need a ride to the doctor or if you need someone just to call and check in on you.
I joke that I'm only interested in developing friendships with people who are at least 10 years younger than me.
Oh, that's a good idea.
I'm only talking to you if you're preferably 20, because I've got longevity in my family. I'm going to be around for a very, very long time. We just have time for one last question, and that is, as it relates to your finances, what are the top things that a solo senior should be thinking about in addition to how are they going to manage their daily financial needs, you know, the banking and bill paying and stuff? What else should they have top of mind as they think about their finances?
Very good question. That's probably the biggest issue that we deal with. And I think, you know, it's setting a budget, and you have got to live within your budget. And I know that people love to spend money. They love to go out. They love being entertained. And that's important to some point, but it's critical that you form a budget and you follow it. And never, ever spend outside that budget, because you never know what you might face in the next 6 months. There's always an emergency, unfortunately, that hits, that can really surprise us. and may require some, you know, some financial, you know, necessities.
Right. Well, that's very helpful perspective, Carol. We appreciate you taking the time.
Absolutely. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Carol Marak is an advocate for solo seniors. She joined us to talk about some of the challenges that people face if they are aging alone.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
There are six kids in my family. My parents took great pains to ensure that they didn't play favorites, which is not to say that we did not try. We tried. Perhaps it is time to revisit that game, but with your financial advisor. Our next guest argues that there is a benefit to becoming your advisor's favorite client. Fraser Rice is the author of Wealth, Actually, Intelligent Decision-Making for the 1%. He joins us from Boston. Hello there.
Bruce, thank you very much.
Is this a nod to the movie Love, Actually? Have I picked that up correctly?
A little bit. I was struggling with the title, and I woke up from a fitful sleep with the TV on to the channel guide, and Love Actually happened to be there, and stranger things happen.
Perfect. Well, a great holiday movie if there ever was one. Now tell me, why should people become their wealth manager's favorite client?
I think one of the important things is that it guarantees that you get their attention and the level of service that you require. By becoming a wealth advisor's favorite client, it ensures that you're getting their attention. A wealth advisor many times has a lot of competing interests for their attention, whether it's going out and finding new clients or dealing with larger ones that are very complicated and requiring certain things, or even it may just be the phone is ringing with four different people on the other end of the line at the same time. And so if you're a good client, and that can take many different forms, that ensures that you get the attention that you deserve.
Isn't that the opposite of how it's supposed to work? Aren't they supposed to be working hard to be my favorite service provider?
You'd think so. But at the end of the day, the service and business models that drive revenue and ultimately drive the compensation for wealth advisors, that it takes precedence. And I lived in the industry where you had to triage certain things, and ultimately you tried to do the best you can with what you have, but we all have limited resources to service clients and businesses and so on, and ultimately tough choices have to be made. So when you're in that situation where an advisor has to make tough choices, or they have trouble getting back to you, or you're not getting the level of attention that you need, then it's important for you to be prepared, do the little things to try to make it easy for them to help advise you.
Is this the kinder, gentler version of the squeaky wheel gets the grease?
I think you don't even need to be kind in many cases, especially if you're not getting the attention that you signed up for. But by the same token, I think being civil and polite, I think that goes a long way. I think being prepared goes a long way. I think having some forethought and understanding what your issues are so that what can be done in a 15-minute phone call doesn't necessarily take a one-hour meeting. Those types of things help to make things more efficient at the advisor end, and that ultimately makes you a good client in their eyes.
So civil, prepared. What other actions can people take to make sure that they're in the good books?
I think one of the great things, what made a good client for me was when clients were prepared, and I've just said that before, but it bears repeating. And being prepared means a bunch of different things. I think, first of all, having your information at the ready, meaning knowing where your assets are, having an idea of what your estate plan is or isn't, so that you can come to an advisor meeting understanding what you may need or not need. That helps the advisor. It helps in the listening and information gathering process, which is always a little bit difficult. But then in the advisor's ability to diagnose the problems that are in place. And ultimately, I think that's where if you're prepared and you're able to deal with uncertainty, I think that's where that's where an advisor really can add value and provide the advice they need to kind of help you chart your course going forward.
Are there any things on the stop doing list? What are the super duper annoyances that if we were aware of, we might do less frequently?
I think the important thing is you're more than allowed to call your advisor whenever you want. I think if you are working with an advisor that has set out to have quarterly meetings and that you're in an asset allocation situation and that he's trying to get you to think in terms of the long-term horizon, and then you come with daily phone calls asking whether you should buy or sell Tesla or some individual name and something that doesn't necessarily align with the operating model of the firm, I think that's where you get into real trouble. And that should be set out pretty early on in the relationship. When choosing an advisor, I try to tell people that understand what the firm does and what they don't do ahead of time, so that if you sign on and then you're going to try to get something else out of them that you didn't have before, that's going to be an unpleasant experience.
Is there any way for advisors to give their clients feedback and cultivate a better working relationship? Because it is kind of a tough balance here, given that the client is paying the bill, they're buying a service, and yet there are things, as you mentioned, that don't seem like they're that difficult for clients to do, that if a client knew, they could improve the efficacy of that relationship. How hard is it for advisors to deliver that feedback to clients?
It's tough. I think that you want to set out early on and have an understanding of what you do and don't do. And when you revisit the situation, whether you're reviewing performance or a client is coming to you with a change in circumstances that needs to be dealt with in their lives, and so that the advice may change and that you may need to deal with something different. If you have those guardrails set up ahead of time as it relates to service standards, as it relates to communication standards, as it relates to what's reasonable to be expected, you can avoid what I would describe as scope creep, where all of a sudden a client starts asking for certain things and then they start asking for more things, and then you're doing more things that you're not getting paid for, and all of a sudden your pie chart of time starts to get dominated more with ministerial duties as opposed to advice or overall larger practice management issues. That's when it gets very difficult. I think the best thing to do is make sure you understand upfront what the service standards are, obviously live up to them. And if there are things that are sort of extraneous or unusual, frame out ahead of time for the client that, you know, this is something that requires a different level of attention and probably a different level of fee. By the same token, I would say that that's not an easy conversation to have when a client is paying a lot of money, especially in a world where an account level fee is significant. And if you look in pure dollar basis, people start saying, well, what am I getting for my money?
Right.
You know, that's something that you want to get ahead of time so that those fee arguments are muted in the future.
Well, I love this topic. One of the things I take on when I go to a restaurant is to be the server's favorite customer, the favorite customer of the evening. Not only because I think you get better service that way, but also because it's kind of a fun game to play. So you and I are on the same page.
Absolutely. I think one of the things, too, and part of being part of adding value to the client is providing stories that you're seeing from other clients that you have or from
right.
other experiences that you're hearing about. I think a lot of sort of the value add that you give to a client is letting them hear what you're seeing elsewhere, so that it's not just a lonely existence where it's you and your advisor against the
right.
world. If the advisor has other experiences that help make the client make their experience a little bit better, that's something I would be talking about.
Yeah.
And that goes back to the idea of having client events so that clients can meet other clients if they're comfortable with that, and building that camaraderie around your practice.
Fraser, thanks for joining us today.
Terrific. Thanks, Bruce. Appreciate it.
Fraser Rice is the author of Wealth, Actually, Intelligent Decision Making for the 1%. We were talking about how to become your advisor's favorite client. Coming up next on Moolala, how to beat the bank and save on investment fees. Author Larry Bates will be here. And later, we look at what you need to know when adding a car to your back-to-school shopping list. Auto Trader's Jacob Black will be our guest. You can email us any financial questions or comments about the show. ask@moolala.ca is our address. We'll be right back.
listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
You work hard for your money. You make sacrifices to save it. You take risks in the market for growth, and you trust your bank to treat you fairly. But sometimes it doesn't really work out that way. The fees banks charge can be really high, and the service levels that you get for those fees can be low. So if you wonder why your bank-sold mutual funds aren't really going anywhere, Larry Bates says he has the answer. He's the author behind Beat the Bank, the Canadian Guide to Simply Successful Investing. He joins us now to discuss it. Hi there.
Hi there, Bruce.
Why did you decide to write this book? You spent your career working at the big banks. Are you a turncoat?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe a little bit of a rebel. But I had a great career in the investment banking business, over 30-plus years dealing with large institutional investors in Toronto, Canada. I also spent some time working in London, England.
What'd you want to do with this book?
Well, you know, just to back to your first question, the reason I wrote the book, or the reason I've done this, is because it became apparent to me a few years ago through conversations with family who were investing in mutual funds that they weren't being very well served. Mm. They didn't understand the impact of the costs they were paying, and it bothered me. So, you know, the short story is, this is what ended up with the book.
You feature a case study near the beginning of the book that has two families, the Meeks and the Ables. I like it. They both invest $10,000 a year. The Meeks show a gain of $170,000. The Ables have a gain of $556,000, three times as much. This is crazy. These numbers are crazy. Why the big difference?
Well, two reasons. One, the biggest difference is fees. For most Canadians, they're buying mutual funds. They're told, they're recommended, they're advised to buy mutual funds. 5 million Canadians own these things. Mutual funds only return about half of the return of the market. The rest, 50%, is lost in fees. You know, that's a deal that no one knowingly would take, but you know, investors are unaware of that.
I wrote my first book, I don't know, 8 years ago. I talked about this.
Yeah.
Most personal finance columnists have been talking about and writing about this for so long. Why do you think it's not getting through? Why is the message not getting through?
Well, I think that normal consumer buyer beware attitude is not there. I think the banks and the industry generally have done a great job of convincing investors that, look, this is way too complicated. It's over your head. Don't even bother trying. Just trust us. And, you know, Canadians largely have bought that marketing line. And also, fees aren't charged directly. As you know, they're simply deducted from retirement accounts, you know, month by month. And people don't notice. It's like high-cost mutual funds are like the cigarettes of the investment industry, okay? You don't notice the change or the damage day-to-day, but over time, serious damage.
You write about, and you use the phrase, old Bay Street. There are a lot of fintechs, there are robo-advisors, and there's a younger generation of executives taking over. Are you optimistic that things are changing?
Well, I think things are changing. But, you know, and there are very efficient, low-cost ways to invest that'll give you a bigger nest egg at the end of the day. And those options are growing and fantastic.
I talk
about that a lot in the book.
Yeah, tell us about some of the options.
There's a couple main options. Obviously, using an online discount broker is an option. But, you know, a lot of people stay away from that because they think they have to make the decisions. They have to pick their stocks, analyze their stocks, and so forth. Of course, you don't have to do that. You can select low-cost index funds that charge a tiny fraction of what mutual funds charge. You pick the right balance, you can be all set, and you can pay for an index fund over 20 years what you'd pay for a mutual fund in 1 year.
You sound pessimistic, or at least suspicious, about the role of regulators. How come?
Well, I do some work with the regulators, and there are a lot of good people across the country in regulators trying to do the right thing. But our whole regulatory system is a mess. We've got 13 securities commissions in Canada. You know, the U.S. has one. The U.K. has one. We've got 13, one for every province and territory. That's messed up. The primary regulators of the advisors out there are what's called self-regulatory organizations. They regulate themselves. So the regulatory system is very poorly designed, chaotic, impossible to get 13 regulators to agree on the same thing at the same time. And the industry has heavy, heavy influence over the regulatory system. And, you know, investor advocacy, they're out there. Others, there's lots of folks who are advocating for investors, but they're not organized and there's no money for that. Mm. So
you cite a paper called The Misguided Beliefs of Financial Advisors, and it asserts, that paper asserts that advisors invest the same way as their clients and therefore pay the same fees. Why do you think that is? Do they drink the Kool-Aid?
Wow, that was just a shocking read. That
I can't decide if it's better or worse. Is it better that they're, you know, they actually are walking the talk, or is it worse because they're suffering the same fate?
I wonder the same thing, but it is frightening that this was a huge study of thousands of investors and advisors across Canada, and basically concluded that the advisors were, number one, giving terrible advice, and number two, following their own advice. And they and their clients were lagging the market by around 3% a year. And you add that up over 20 or 30 years and you're crushed. Mm.
You outline the six forces of wealth building. Three wealth builders, three wealth killers.
Yeah.
The builders, amount, time, and rate. Is this coming back to the mom and apple pie compound interest magic?
Yeah, I mean, it's the basic formula, you know, and those three elements, those three wealth builders, the amount you invest, the time period, and the rate of return, individually mean a lot, but in combination can produce astonishing numbers over time, as you know.
The killers, fees we've talked about, tax and inflation are the other two. Is there anything that can be done on the inflation front?
No, you just got to beat inflation.
You can't buy enough bread for a lifetime and keep it in your basement?
No, you have to earn, you have to beat inflation with your investment portfolio just to stay even.
Did anyone try and discourage you from writing this particular book? If you asked me if you should write a book, I would say no because it's way too hard. But this particular book seems – it is a highly critical view of the industry that enabled you to pay off your mortgage.
You know, I haven't had people tell me I shouldn't write the book. I know there are those that will disagree with the book or won't like the book. And I actually, you know, frankly, I try to be a bit provocative because it's not going to do anybody any good if nobody reads it. So, but I do think the industry deserves some criticism. I don't have any problem with banks. I believe in capitalism. Companies should aim to make a profit, but they should treat their clients fairly. And I just don't think that's the case with Canadian individual investors largely. I think the lack of understanding and the lack of real honest advice should be called out.
If there is one takeaway from your book for the average Canadian person out there living their life, what would that one takeaway be? What is the one behavior you would want readers of your book or listeners to this interview? What is the one thing you would want them to do?
Take a little bit of time to learn investment basics. It's not that complicated. It can be very simple. In fact, the simpler, the better. And even if you choose to stay with expensive mutual funds, whatever your choice may be, you'll be with a little bit of understanding. You'll be much better positioned to make the right decisions for yourself and your family.
Knowledge pays.
Learn a little, earn a lot.
Ooh, nice. I like it. Larry Bates, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Bruce.
Larry is the author of Beat the Bank, The Canadian Guide to Simply Successful Investing. Coming up later on the program, we'll take you through the Moolala questionnaire with Carol Marak. But next, before you say I do, we'll look at how women can protect their financial interests in a relationship. Follow me at Bruce Selry on Twitter, Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. Stay with us. There's more Moolala after this break.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
I'm Bruce Ellery. You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple. Being able to talk about money should be a basic part of any relationship, but it can be tough to do. As more women become the primary breadwinners in their households, they really need to know how to balance the shared needs of the family with their own personal financial security. Meridian's Amy Burke is here to talk about this subject. Hello there, Amy.
Hello, Bruce. Good afternoon.
Hi. I have never heard this idea when we talk about men. Why do we talk about it when it comes to women? I know there are so many different gender dynamics here. Why do you think it's different for women?
I don't even know that it is different for women. I think that because times are changing, we're more vocal about it than we ever used to be. The traditional household many years ago was that the male was the significant breadwinner of the family, and he would be looking into doing that. It's very common with celebrities, as you would know, being one yourself, to have that discussion prior to getting into a relationship because we're talking large dollars. Well, nowadays, women are starting their careers earlier, they're getting married later, and more frequently, as women, we are making the same or more than our counterparts. So that raises questions that perhaps weren't raised in the past.
Yeah, I think you're being generous. I think it would not be inaccurate to say that many men are simply more selfish and their personal financial security would be important to protect, whereas potentially the female might think more about the collective of the family first. I don't know. Maybe that's a topic for another debate. Oh, but let me ask you this. So I remember when my parents got divorced in the late 70s, how hard it was for my mom to just get a credit card back then. Are there still systemic barriers for women, or are we through that?
There's definitely still barriers. And I think the barriers are simply because we are not educated. Finances are kind of like going to the dentist. Nobody wants to do it. You know, it's necessary evil. Nobody wants a cavity, but nobody really wants to go. And I've tried to share that knowledge with both men and women because I think we avoid the things we dislike. And talking about money and debt and borrowing is not always sexy or fun. Mm. So to really kind of hammer and hone in there, I mean, we're not learning this in school. We're not teaching financial literacy in school. So the first time, sometimes that we learn about it is the first credit card we get in maybe university. So to get into a relationship and not have a proper discussion about money and not sit with a financial advisor or at least a professional in the industry is very common, but it's can be very detrimental.
You have some suggestions of things that women could do or should do as they try and find that balance between the collective and the personal. One is keep their own separate pot of money. Is this like hidden away in a Swiss bank account unbeknownst to their partner? Or, you know, like what are we talking here in terms
of
intrigue and secrecy?
Not secrecy. And I think that's really the key. I think the key is transparency, but that doesn't mean you have to commingle. So that's a very typical term used when you and I get married and we put all of our funds together. They've commingled and now they are our funds. It is more and more common nowadays to have my funds, your funds, and our funds, but certainly not hiding the money. It's more about having autonomy within a relationship. It is not uncommon to commingle all funds, but a discussion certainly should be had beforehand about how those funds are going to be used, the relationship with money. I think those things are very, very important.
What are the financial topics? So there are many things that need to be discussed before people get married. And I've talked about that on this program before. And, you know, the level of debt that you're bringing in and attitudes towards money and all that stuff. What would be on your standing agenda for couples who they're married? They may have been married for a while. What are the topics that they need to continue to surface over time, not only so that issues don't fester, but also that they keep the financial train on the tracks?
Well, I think it's important to have a review and not make it something that is onerous. Make it something that's enjoyable. Maybe you crack open a bottle of your favorite wine or a glass of beer or a cup of tea, and you say, okay, this is our family meeting. If you're already married, you're already sharing a financial future together, inevitably. So if you're married or you're living together, the law sees you as a couple, and therefore the law can often make decisions about what happens to your money, A, if you get divorced, or God forbid, B, if you pass away. And it's really important to be having those discussions regularly. So life events such as the birth of children, short-term and long-term plans. Do you want to go on a vacation? Or B, do you want to get your MBA? Mm-hmm. How do you want your retirement to look? These types of questions are really what should be tabled on a regular basis, maybe every 6 months, maybe once a year.
The gender pay gap is a real thing. It plays out in the statistics. And in some families, that's because often the female, not always, but often the female has made a choice or has, for circumstantial reasons, is required or is needed in the home. How do women voice their needs around money when they aren't the one directly bringing that paycheck in? Because I talk to a lot of women and I kind of like growl a little bit because it feels like their needs are not receiving the attention that they should, given that they're partnering a family. They just don't happen to be the one putting the paycheck in the bank.
I think it really depends on the relationship, which is why the conversations are so important before the life events occur. Sometimes you can't. Sometimes, surprise, you're having a baby. But having those conversations beforehand to offset some of those feelings, you know, the feelings of, you know, having to ask, quote unquote, for money from your partner while you're raising the children that you've both agreed to have, that can be very defeating. So I think it's really important, again, talk about what's going to happen if there is a maternity leave or a paternity or a shared. You can do a mat leave coupled with a pat leave. Or maybe you're adopting. What does that look like? What does that feel like? What's your relationship with money? How will you continue to keep some autonomy while sharing responsibilities? And sometimes the responsibilities are, I'm going to stay home and take care of the household and the children as they're growing, while you will bring in an income. Both of them are very, very important jobs for a good, solid family foundation.
We just have 30 seconds left. You and I both have daughters. They are young. What is the number one value that you are endeavoring to cultivate for your daughter and believe that other parents should cultivate for their young women?
Education around finance. I think financial literacy is a life skill, much like cooking or learning to sew or learning to swim or driving a car, that we often overlook as kind of a thing that happens, but that it happens to you, when realistically, you should have control over your money. So financial literacy, and there's so many resources available. All you have to do is pop into your financial institution and ask.
Amy, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a blast.
It was great to meet you over the radio. Amy Burke is with Meridian Credit Union. She was in Milton, Ontario today. Coming up next, adding a car to your back-to-school shopping list. We'll get some shopping and saving tips from Auto Trader's Jacob Black. And we'll take Senior Care's Carol Marack through the Moolala questionnaire. Let's talk book club. I know, you usually read fiction, but how about changing it up and bringing some moolala into your book club? You can find and order either of my two personal finance books online. Even better, go to the library. I love the library. Just borrow them. There's a discussion guide for book clubs to use in the back. Stick around. We will be back. Ooh, like that. The back of the book. We'll be right back after the break.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Cars for kids. Well, they're not really kids, but I love alliteration, so I'm saying cars for kids. Post-secondary education is rarely offered right around the corner from your house. Sure, public transportation might get you there, but it also might not. So maybe there is a car purchase in your future, or in the young person's future who happens to live in your house. Here with some cost-effective car shopping tips is Auto Trader's Jacob Black. Hello there.
Hi.
I hate car shopping. Like, hate it. Hate it. I want my car to be there. I want it to work and start. But that is it. So let's start from the perspective of the student. What are some factors that a student should consider when it comes to shopping for that car, which maybe was probably their first car?
Especially when it's their first car, you know, and it's really easy for anybody to get excited and swept up in that excitement of such an, Oh, absolutely. And it's a milestone purchase. And if they care about cars at all, then there's probably some excitement. Maybe they care about performance, all those sorts of things. Really, everybody's going to be different. There's no one size fits all. You can't say to a kid, hey, you should consider reliability and safety when you buy your first car, because
they will not. They're going to say, are you talking to my grandmother? Because don't use that phrase.
That's right.
Right.
And so what you really need to do is all have a conversation, everybody that's involved in that purchase, and say, look, what are the things that we really care about? Maybe your student has a hockey team. Maybe they have a band. Maybe they really love driving. Maybe they love style. All of those things they need to take into account. And once they've taken into account sort of what's most important to them, then they can move on to the next steps.
Right. You do have a list of steps here, and I probably skipped the first one. Set a budget. How do you set a budget? I have no idea. For a used car, I don't even know what people would pay. So how do you come up with that number?
It's really important not only to identify how much you've got to play with. Maybe you've been working summers for the last 6 years planning this in advance. Maybe you've had some help from someone and you've got some money. Maybe you've got a really great job alongside your studies. Just find out what you've got to spend. And then from that, make sure you take out what you're going to need for fuel, what you're going to need for repairs, what you're going to need for insurance. Really lump in all of the costs and do yourself a little mini budget, a little mini spreadsheet. You know, break out the Excel. Break out the Excel with your parents. Make them do it too. Go through and find out how much you realistically have to spend on a car each month, not just that upfront purchase.
Tip two is make a checklist, and you've mentioned some of the variables on this checklist. Tip three, do your research. What are the benefits of shopping around?
The benefits of shopping around are not only confidence, so you know what's there, but also that you get a really great sense of what you can afford for the money. So where it is that you want to, you know, maybe make a compromise on some of the things that you care about versus things that you don't. And there are over 400,000 cars on autotrader.ca, right? So it's difficult to really narrow it down. But once you have got that, and that's why we say set the budget and set your checklist first, because then you've got that little slightly narrower funnel. You go onto autotrader.ca, you look at everything that's around you, and then you've got this really crystal clear idea of what you can actually do with the money that's available to you.
What's the sweet spot on price versus the age of the car? And I ask because one of the things that people often talk about is at about 4 years, you have people who leased going off lease and bringing their car onto the market. So there's that inventory. But then there are certain people who aren't going to drive a car into the ground, so they're going to drive it for whatever that number is, 8 to 10 years. Is there a way to think about, listen, I'm going to get the best value if I look for a car that is X years old?
I think that there's so many moving parts in that equation, especially because each individual car, you know, its reliability is really a function of past care and past use. But what you can do is there are some general rules of thumb. So just like in real estate, we say buy the worst house on the best street and all of those sorts of things. We know, and in stocks, we say diversify. In cars, one of the great rules of thumbs to follow is buy the newest thing that you can afford in your price range that fits your needs the best. So if you've got a $5,000 to $10,000 price range and there's a vehicle that looks really great and it's a 2003, but then a vehicle that is a little bit less of what you want, but it's a 2013, maybe lean in that direction for that maximum value, peace of mind sort of return.
How do you reduce the influence of brand? Because for X dollars, we'll buy you this type of car, but it's going to be X plus $3,000 to buy one with a fancier brand, even if reliability is the same and upkeep is the same. How do you, as a student in particular, how do you overcome the ego stuff associated with, I'm driving I don't even know what brand would be cool because I'm not a cool car owner. But how do you work that through?
I think that's really a function of psychology and probably a question for a psychologist more than anyone else. But one of the ways that you mitigate the risks of getting swept up in that brand excitement is, like we said, just doing that research. I'm sure it's a familiar refrain to everyone that listens to this show. Anytime you talk about any sort of financial decision, the more research that you do, the more time you take and energy that you spend in really crystallizing your task list and your list of needs and desires, the better off you'll be and the less likely you'll be to get sort of swept off in a bad emotional decision.
There's no way for you to give me an objective answer on this last question, but it is this. What are the pros and cons of Auto Trader versus buying a used car at a dealership or going on Kijiji and finding one of the, you know, thousands of cars out there?
It's a great question. I mean, first of all, it's important to know that there are new and used cars, private sales, and dealerships on autotrader.ca. So you're going to really, on autotrader.ca, you're going to get access to every single vehicle that's on the market in your area. You're going to find it on autotrader.ca, whether or not you want to buy a new, used, off a lease, off a private seller. All of those things are available to you. We've got really strong tools for helping people narrow down what they want from a car. So we've got some really great search refinement tools. We've got some great valuation tools. And we've got a really great content site as well that I'm the editor of, where we talk about...
Well, then it must be great. You're the editor of it.
Well, we talk about, you know, all of the hints and tips, and we have objective reviews. We have, you know, some of Canada's best and most respected writers really going through and helping you make that decision with confidence. So when you go to autotrader.ca, like I said, there's over 400,000 cars. There's new and used cars, you know, and often new cars below MSRP. You've got dealerships. You've got private sellers. It really is the best one-stop shop.
What do you do if you've turns out you bought a lemon?
Turns out if you've bought a lemon. Now, you've got some recourse if you bought it from a dealer and that dealer is a member of OMVIC or any of the trade associations. There's remedies through them and you can contact them. But really the best cure is prevention, and that's why we advocate things like getting your pre-purchase inspection, spending that time and money to check out the car that you're going to buy. You're spending money, you may as well spend a little bit of money right up front just to make sure that you can be confident in the choice that you've made.
Interesting. Jacob, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Jacob Black is with Auto Trader. We're talking about cars for kids, or like young adults, I should say. Time now for the Moolala Questionnaire. This is our series of questions about money, a little bit about life. Carol Marak is our guest today. She is the Chief Public Relations Officer at Senior Care and an advocate for solo seniors and what are also called elder orphans, those groups in particular. So, Carol, I want you to answer just the first thing that comes to your mind. Are you ready?
Yes, let's go for it.
How would you describe your money personality?
Conservative.
Conservative. And why do you think that is?
Oh, because I've learned from when I was younger, I was a spendthrift. I mean, I spent a lot of money and that got me in trouble. And I learned my lesson in my early 30s.
Ooh, that's good. That's good that it was your early 30s and not your early 40s.
Oh, right. I know. I had plenty of time to make up. Thank you very much.
What is one financial behavior that you still would say, I'm still working on that one?
Healthy food.
Healthy food. Yes. Do you have a food vice that is also an expensive one?
Yes.
Are you a big fan of Peking duck or, I don't know, fancy sushi?
No. It's just organic foods, healthy eating. I'm a nut. And I will spend maybe three times more than just the conventional, product or produce.
Right. Three times more for a banana blessed by the wings of a fairy. I understand.
Absolutely.
I get it. So this may be the same answer, but it might be a different one. What is one of your guilty spending pleasures aside from, you know, mangoes that come from the center of the earth?
Travel.
Travel. Okay. Looking ahead, what is one destination you are dying to go to? You know it's going to be super expensive, but when you get there, it'll be totally worth it.
I am planning to live for a whole month in Europe. It's going to either be in Italy or in the Czech Republic. I'm not sure yet.
Oh, spectacular. Both. Now, I will say beer is better in the Czech Republic. Wine is better in Italy. So that should weigh into your decision. I hope it does. What does financial freedom mean to you?
Traveling more, not worrying about buying organic, healthy
food. You need to start your own organic farm here.
Exactly. Just doing what I want, and not necessarily being, extravagant. By no means am I that, but I mean, I would love to have have you heard of the vampire facelift?
No, what is that?
Well, they actually withdraw blood from your body and then somehow filter out the plasma that will, and then re-inject it into your face. So it's very natural and organic, so you don't have to worry about fillers or all these chemicals. So that's what I want. I mean, I would love to do that.
Oh, that sounds great. I just ask everyone to turn the lighting down. Just if you can't see me, I look 25 again. It's cheaper.
Yeah, that's cheaper.
I'm telling you, it's much cheaper. What is one topic when it comes to personal finance you talk about on your Facebook page for solo seniors, you talk about and you could talk about forever and ever and you still would be passionate about it?
On finances,
yeah.
Like I mentioned before, it's setting a budget and sticking with it.
Mm.
I'm really, really passionate about that.
Yeah. If you landed a huge financial windfall, say $25 million, what, aside from all those organic vegetables that you would now buy, what would you do with $25 million?
I would create a foundation for the elderly who are in desperate need.
Mm. Wow. And what kind of services would they provide?
In-home care, for one, good food, for another, and free transportation.
That's great. Carol, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And thank you for your leadership and your passion for solo seniors. That really is an extraordinary bit of work, and we appreciate you doing that.
Oh, well, thank you, Bruce. I appreciate that.
All right. Carol Merrock is Chief Public Relations Officer at Senior Care. She is an advocate for solo seniors. That is our show for today. If you want some more Moolala, you can go to our website, moolala.ca, or head on over to iTunes, where you can download the podcast version of this show. And we have all of our past episodes up there. You can write a review on iTunes. You can subscribe to the next episode. So many things. Now, we're hanging out on the radio, but I also do a lot of television. I'm the money columnist for show called City Line. It is syndicated across North America. And if you want to check out some of those segments, cityline.tv is the URL. Thank you very much for joining us and have a great day.